From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
This law guarantees a right to voters in high population counties in Illinois that it doesn't give to voters in low population counties in Illinois. And that's not fair. That's giving an opportunity, an important opportunity, to people in high population counties that it doesn't give to people in low population counties.
During the March 2016 primaries, thousands of eligible persons registered and voted using Election Day registration, and many people believe that they're going to be able to do it again, and changing these rules at this late date really creates an obstacle to people being able to vote.
That's Ed Yonka with the ACLU of Illinois, and before him, Jacob Hubert with the Liberty Justice Center. The two at odds over a decision that took place this week, a judge blocking same-day voter registration in Illinois. We're going to talk more about that decision. Also, just how bad are the state's finances? There seems to be some disagreement there. And Chicago gets a shout-out in the presidential debate, but it wasn't necessarily good publicity. We'll talk about all of that and more today. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel for State Week includes Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio, Brian Mackey, IPR reporter. Also with us today, Kent Redfield, U of I Springfield Political Studies Professor. And joining us in our State House studio is Doug Finke, State House reporter for Gatehouse Media. Doug, good to have you back on.
Glad to be here.
Let me start, Brian Mackey, with you. The judge siding basically with Republicans this week who have been complaining about this same-day voter registration law. What is this law all about? And also, what was the judge's decision?
This law would have required the state's biggest cities and counties and election authorities to let citizens register to vote on Election Day at their local polling place. If you're in a more rural, less populous area of the state, you could still register on Election Day. You just have to go to a central location, generally the county seat, wherever the election headquarters was. And this group called the Liberty Justice Center, they say they're separate from the Illinois Policy Institute, the conservative think tank. They happen to share office space. They were, I believe, founded by them, but they claim to be independent. Anyway, it's a conservative legal group. They sued. They didn't like the idea of it. The judge, federal judge Samuel Duryagin, in his order noted the fact that when this law was passed, it had Democrats voting yes, Republicans voting no. You look at where the most populous counties in election authorities are in Illinois, and those tend to be more Democratic areas. Although the opponents of or the people who defend this law, at least, will point out that, you know, both Democrats and Republicans took advantage of this same-day registration when it was in place in the primary this year.
And, of course, the ACLU was complaining the fact that this decision coming down just a few weeks before Election Day, that might disenfranchise people who think they can just show up there and cast a ballot.
Yeah, and you would imagine that this may be part of the strategy of some of the campaigns where, you know, nowadays we talk a lot about the ground game and how important it is for get out the vote efforts. And if campaigns and individual voters are counting on, well, I moved, and, you know, it used to be you had to remember to change your registration 28 days ahead of time. Now, if you've moved since the primary, you just want to show up at your polling place and vote, you may be in for a rude surprise. And something else somebody pointed out to me here in thinking about this is that if you are downstate in a, I don't know, let's say a rural county, and you know you have to drive to Taylor. Let's say Christian County. You have to drive to Taylorville. You could probably do that in about 15, 20 minutes from anywhere in that county. If you are in the suburbs of Cook County and you have to drive downtown Cook County, you're talking about half a day probably, you know, on a work day, which Election Day is.
Is this going to be a problem for Democrats come Election Day, Kent?
It's a minor problem. I mean, you know, you're trying to get people to register to vote. It's part of, you know, you've got a strategy there in terms of contacting people. You do early voting, then you're going to do try to get the registrations built up. The more that they can get people, you know, the bank the votes ahead of time. And but this is, you know, the election day strategy is about, if you find some people, then you can get them registered. Hopefully, you have time to do that if you've done all of the things that come before it. And so while it does fit into this kind of national pattern of a battle between kind of making it easier or harder to vote, depending on how you define that, this is not an overwhelming problem, although, again, because you've changed the rules slightly. I mean, obviously anybody got registered in the primary doesn't need to worry about re-registering in the fall. But, there's confusion there, and it's unfortunate. I mean, no, it is not unusual in Illinois for us to pass laws that are administered slightly differently in big counties versus small counties, and there certainly was in terms of, there was more in this bill than just that. And part of the discussion was about, in rural counties, we don't have, the personnel to do the training and stuff. It's much, Cook County, they've got this huge organization, and therefore, you make a distinction. But when you make distinctions that involve First Amendment rights, which is really what we're talking about here, then the courts generally take a very, very narrow view of things. And so, it would have maybe been nice to sue to say, let's require it, everybody, rather than let's just throw the law out. And, we'll fix this, next time around by focusing on, what are we really trying to do, which is facilitate people participating in the process.
You've studied voter trends for years. I mean, Kent, have you seen that these types of things, have they really helped turnout that much?
It does. I mean, you've got a declining turnout and less engagement. It does allow you to, if you've got the resources, to focus and to get your people out. Whether it's contributing to overall turnout, there's a whole bunch of factors there. But obviously the professionals that run campaigns can fit these things into their strategies, and it gives them, more options, more flexibility.
And Amanda, you wanted to weigh in there?
I just wanted to add a couple of things here. First of all, is when we're talking about expanding this law potentially statewide, I do think that there is a certain irony there, given, again, the organization that brought this lawsuit, its connection to the Illinois Policy Institute, a conservative group that very much says that Illinois and its local governments spend too much money. What, of course, would this do if there was to be an expansion? It's costly when you already have county clerks and local government saying that they don't have enough as is. And as you have Governor Bruce Rauner, of course, having talked about trying to limit local property taxes and having previously also wanting to cut into the money that they get from basically that is sent to them from the state. That's the easiest way to describe that. So there's that perspective to look at. I will add that it does come as Illinois over the years has made it a lot easier for voters to be able to register. You can to take advantage of this grace period of registration, which does mean that you need to vote the same time you register right up until the day before the election. So people that I've spoken with casually in conversation say, okay, yes, this is an issue, and clearly we had very long lines, particularly in Chicago and Springfield, for people that were going to register and vote on election day. And yet, it's human nature to procrastinate, wait until the last minute. And yet Illinois really has gone and made it very easy for people to register to vote over the years. The exception, of course, the legislature did pass automatic voter registration this session that would have basically said anytime you interact with the government, say, get a new driver's license, change your address, what have you, you would automatically be registered to vote. And that is a measure that Governor Bruce Rauner vetoed. So we'll have to watch and see what happens in the veto session. And although it did pass with enough support that it could be veto proof, obviously, Governor Bruce Rauner having said no to it could lead more Republicans to get off of that. So that'll be part of the dynamic here that may change even even the necessity of this law or what have you. And then one last thing, speaking of casual conversations, I have to say that I did speak just casually again with a Republican legislator who, upon hearing the news of the court's decision, was very relieved. So I think that that does indicate that the Republicans feel that this is a law, because you have city voters tending to vote Democratic, would have very much favored the Democratic Party, and therefore from a political perspective, but also this legislator said from just a sheer fairness perspective, was relieved that it had gotten tossed out.
My guess is he is on the ballot this November for being that relieved with that. Well, of course, we have elections that everybody's watching, certainly, but there is another bigger issue as well that's actually going to be going past Election Day, and that is the state's budget. And right now there seems to be disagreement over just how big the state's budget deficit is. The governor says it's less than the number that the legislature's forecasting arm, the Commission for Government and Forecasting Accountability, has put out. Doug Finke, can you sort this out for us and maybe come up with a number that is actually a little more accurate?
Well, I'll try to. COGFA, as the commission is known, was asked right after this, the legislature passed the stopgap budget, was asked by a lawmaker, what does this do to the deficit? And they crunched the numbers and came up with a figure of, I believe it was around $7.8 billion. They said that's what the deficit would be at the end of the year if you carried the stopgap budget out to the entire fiscal year. That was done back in July. Just this last week, the administration, as part of a plan to go to the bond market in mid-October, prepared some documents for the bond sale and said that they think the deficit is actually going to be $5.4 billion. They explained, first of all, they bent over backwards to say they were not trying to pick a fight with COGFA. They said that a couple of factors weighed into their numbers. One, we're several months into the fiscal year at this point, and so they have a better picture of what state spending looks like and what kind of, for example, federal reimbursements we're going to get, that sort of thing. They also said that COGFA, when they computed their numbers back in July, did not take into consideration a few factors. One, or a couple of revenue sources that COGFA did not include with their estimate that the administration said should have been. For example, the use of the rainy day fund to offset some of the spending. And there was another pot of money that had gone unused the year before that was available. It was about $400 million. Again, the administration said would offset spending in the stopgap measure. Bottom line is the administration says that the deficit is going to be lower, but we're still talking about $5.4 billion. It's a deficit budget. The state is still spending way more money than it's collecting in taxes, so it's really just a matter of degree. It's not a reason for going out and celebrating anything.
And, Doug, when you talk about that number, I mean, we hear the state controller, Leslie Munger, has talked about, you know, numbers that top $15 billion in bills that are due. I mean, are we factoring all of that in? Are we factoring the late bills, maybe the interest payments on the bills? Do we know if that's in the governor's number?
To be honest with you, I can't say that. I mean, we're talking about just the difference between the spending that would occur both with a stopgap, but that was carried out through an entire fiscal year, and what the revenues for that would be. So, that, I mean, we've already got an existing bill backlog. This would just add to the fact that we're going to have a bunch of late bills out there at the end of the year.
I would just say, regardless of which set of numbers you're looking at here, I think this does reinforce and drive home the point that we are still in the midst of an emergency in the state of Illinois. I think that a lot of legislators don't want to talk about that. They were happy to pat themselves on the back for coming up with this stopgap budget plan that lets everybody go home.
Spending plan.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a great clarification. Stopgap spending plan, because it's no way a budget. A budget requires you to plan ahead and think about how much money you're going to take in and decide how much to spend. This is just, taking out a new credit card. This is what the state of Illinois did over the summer with a very high limit and no future planning. So Illinois is still very much in financial crisis. This just drives it home that, you know, we are just making compounding and compounding and compounding the problem.
And what people often forget, I think, with that number too, is most of that money is going to be owed to people in Illinois. It could be doctors, it could be hospitals, it could be some other vendor who did some service, but it's going to be owed. So, I mean, what a drag that's got to be on the economy when you look at that figure.
Yeah, and just to reinforce the theme here, I mean, you know, the reason we want to come up with a smaller number is that we're going out and we're selling bonds. We're borrowing money and not kind of cash flow money. We're actually, you know, we're incurring long-term debt. We'd like to do it as cheaply as possible. But that long-term debt is generating revenue to pay off our backlog of bills. And so it's just more of the robbing Peter to pay Paul and kept kicking the can down the road sort of thing. And so, yeah, it makes, you know, you want to say, let's get it as cheaply as possible. Let's be accurate on the numbers. But the overall theme is, you know, how much are you paying to borrow money to put yourself in long-term debt to pay off unpaid, you know, the bills you're generating because you haven't had a budget for the last 3 years.
You know, Kent, if I didn't know better, I think you were describing some sort of pyramid scheme where you got to pay back this guy, so you borrow some money from that other guy, and you just keep compounding the problem. But you're right. I mean, we've been borrowing from, as Sean pointed out too, we've been borrowing from Illinois businesses for years in order to keep state government going, and it's just getting worse.
Well, they say all publicity is good publicity. I don't think that's necessarily the case. And we heard some of that on Monday night. Donald Trump mentioned Chicago in the presidential debate, basically called it a war zone because of all of the gun crime that's been taking place up there. Is that the notoriety, Brian, I'll throw this to you. Is that the notoriety that the city is really getting on a national level? And is it fair?
Yeah, I mean, it's is it fair? I'll start with that question. The city has certainly seen a huge increase in the number of shootings and homicide deaths this year. Criminologists are still studying what that's about. A couple of the theories you've heard floated are breakdown in the gang structure, which leads to a lot more just factional fighting. There's not a sort of hierarchy that there used to be and the sort of rules of the game that were once there. Another theory you've heard is that it was a very warm year, and so we've had a lot of warm weather, and that puts people out on the street running into each other. They're more likely to have an argument that will escalate in a terrible way. There's the mayor of Chicago likes to talk about guns and how that is what he says is a big problem. It's obviously a problem, but something that he says we need new laws to address as a problem. In terms of what Trump had to say, there has been quite a bit of pushback, particularly from leaders in the African American community who say that, you know, Trump is, the way he talks about Chicago suggests that he doesn't have much experience of what it's like. He used the phrase, African Americans, Hispanics are living in hell because it's so dangerous. You walk down the street, you get shot. Now, yes, Chicago has had a lot of violence, but there are still plenty of people who are going about their lives, living, doing the best they can. And whether this appeals to them in terms of his election, that does not seem to be getting him a great deal of traction with the African American community. But it is certainly drawing attention to Chicago that I don't think anyone in Illinois wants.
But we also cover state government here. I mean, is there something that state government needs to do? Are there some things being proposed that could help with this?
Well, whether it helps is another thing. But yes, there are some things being proposed. The mayor of Chicago has for a long time wanted to increase the penalties for felons who are caught with guns, right? Gun crime penalties and increase mandatory minimum prison sentences. This comes at the same time, however, that the state is looking at maybe reducing those mandatory minimum prison sentences. The governor has talked about how he wants to reduce the prison population by 25% over the next 10 years. The mayor tried to push a bill like this through a couple of years ago, and a coalition of African-American legislators and the Quinn administration, which did not want to see the prison population go up, worked to block it. It was a pretty resounding defeat for the mayor at that time. But given the terrible events we've had this year, he seems to be trying to go down that road again.
It seems like we're going. Go ahead, Amanda.
I was just going to kind of add on to that a little bit, Sean. So the governor did sign a law that was very much backed by Republican leaders as well, that basically a new gun trafficking law. I do think Brian is right. We're going to see a lot, and there are supposedly talks amongst legislators heating in. They had gone on prior to this big speech on violence from Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, but in which he specifically called on Springfield to act in terms of gun sentencing legislation. The governor was asked directly this week about Donald Trump and his comments. The governor said he didn't watch the debate, and he kept up as he has. He says he's not talking politics at all. So even when Illinois' largest city was specifically mentioned by Donald Trump on this, frankly, world stage for that highly watched first presidential debate, Rauner had no comment. However, then Donald Trump, who, despite these references to Chicago as a war zone, sent his daughter Ivanka there this week. Donald Trump had mentioned stop and frisk as something that he believes Illinois needs to institute, and specifically that needs to happen in Chicago. And he begrudged a law that Governor Bruce Rauner had signed that basically says police need to document their stops, write down their name and their badge number. The governor did weigh in on that, and he said it's a matter of striking a balance, but this documentation is a matter of restoring trust when clearly that is lacking between communities in Chicago, particularly minority communities and the police.
Well, I guess Tim Schneider, who was the Illinois GOP chairman at the event, from what was reported, told Donald Trump that he could compete here in Illinois. Now, Kent Redfield, you follow campaign finance. You follow these candidates quite a bit through the years. Is it possible? I mean, we haven't seen a Republican do that well in Illinois in a while. Is he the guy that could actually do well here?
No. The political demographics of the state, we are not going to go for a Republican candidate in the presidential election. I mean, we're playing to audiences other places other than Illinois.
Well, let me ask you, because the stop and frisk discussion, things like that he mentioned during the campaign, does that play well in certain areas of Illinois? Could he do very well and also help some local candidates downstate maybe?
Well, he's, yes. I mean, a downstate community is going to be more conservative, probably represented by Democratic, legislators who have voted consistently for pro-NRA positions. And so to find a lot of space between Republican and Democratic candidates downstate on gun issues is really not possible. I mean, it does add something to the turnout in terms of what voters get there or don't get there. It's marginal in terms of the impact that it has on a legislative race. Those tend to be local. They're going to be played out in the themes. It may be about Governor Rauner versus Mike Madigan, but probably not about the national debate. Ultimately, this is Chicago's problem, and the state can provide resources. You can try to get balanced laws, but the solutions are not coming from Springfield. They're not coming from the federal government or, whoever gets elected president. It's about building relationships, and it's about addressing needs within communities, building mutual trust, and there are all kinds of components on this. And to say, well, we need a war on guns, it's not likely to be any more successful than the war on drugs or the war on poverty. I mean, this is a complex situation, and the community and the political leadership and the community leadership have got to work it out.
Yeah, and I mean, I will say, Kent, the one area I think that the state maybe could have more of a role here is in programs. And there are programs that do work to prevent violence. And some of those programs have been affected negatively by the budget impasse here in Springfield. And so this is something that I've been covering the Governor's Commission on Criminal Justice Reform. There are a number of people there who talk about, you know, this cannot just be about cost savings, reducing the prison population. You need to reinvest that money. They call it justice reinvestment in these communities that have been hurt by violence and hurt by economic problems, right? There are lack of opportunity is one of the things that people point to as to why you have problems with violence in Chicago. So this is something that, you know, I don't think the state should be entirely left off the hook, particularly the budget crisis and how it's related to programs that evidence says do work in some cases.
Kent, I'm only got about a minute here, but I wanted to see, is there any specific races you're watching a lot of in Illinois right now, legislative otherwise?
Oh, certainly. I mean, you know, the focus is in the suburbs and in southern Illinois. There are legislative races involving there are about four Senate races that are, you might get some change. There are half a dozen House races you might get some change with unbelievable spending going on both sides. We're easily going to double the amount. There may be a little bit locally here, but the real battlegrounds are in southern Illinois and in the suburbs around Chicago, which is, you know, but it's going to be the most expensive legislative election in Illinois history. There's no question about that.
All right. It's time for our notes from the field. And Brian Mackey, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I got the newsletter from my high school this week, Marian Catholic in Chicago Heights. They had a picture of the top 10 students who are graduated this year and where they're going to college. It struck me that not one of them, not one, is going to an Illinois public university. In fact, only one is going in-state at all. That's to DePaul. When I was graduated a couple decades ago, I was not in the top 10, but I was friends with many of them, and I can think of at least four people who went to the University of Illinois in Urbana. So yet another sign of people not wanting to take up public higher education in Illinois.
Well, one of those former graduates from the U of I Urbana, Amanda Vinicky, a note from the field.
Wanting to mention that caps have been taken off on the race for comptroller. There's a special election for that this time around. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having a contest until 2 years from now. But Leslie Munger, who herself was a business executive for a long time, her husband, an attorney, put in $260,000 into that race, taking off caps, as with several other races, really, this election cycle.
Doug Finke.
This last week, the largest state employee union, AFSCME, launched a ad campaign reported to be about $500,000. It's not targeted for any candidates, however. It is to reinforce the notion that state workers are dedicated to their jobs and criticizing the governor for not trying to walk away from labor negotiations.
And Kent Redfield.
You know, one of the things that's driving the increase in the cost of elections is money at the top in terms of the wealth of individuals. And we just looked at some numbers in the last 3.5 years. Three individuals, Bruce Rauner, Ken Griffin, and Richard Euland, have contributed all $74 million to Illinois politics. Compares to the top 10 individuals 4 years ago and 8 years ago were $19 million and $14 million, and those three individuals have contributed $74 million.
All right, well, that will wrap it up for today. Members of our broadcast include Amanda Vinicky, Brian Mackey, Kent Redfield, and Doug Finke with Gatehouse Media. You can get a podcast of this show. Just go to nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. Look for State Week. The production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.